Welcome to Body Matters Podcast, where we bring to you raw and inspiring content on all things to do with body positivity and eating disorder recovery.
But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as traditional people and traditional owners of this country. We acknowledge with gratitude First Nations communities for their continuing care and connection to the lands or waters with which they have protected for thousands of years. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that First Nations sovereignty was never ceded.
On this week's episode, I am super excited to be introducing you to two lovely practitioners from Eat Love Live in Melbourne, Director Josephine Money and Dr. Christy Bennett. Eat Love Live is a clinic that offers dietetics and nutrition, physiotherapy, movement classes, music therapy, dance therapy, and education, where both Christy and Joe are the co-founders for Eat Love Live Education. On this week's episode, we will be speaking about why people may be feeling stuck and unable to recover from an eating disorder, where both Joe and Christy draw our attention to the different systemic oppressions, the media, and trauma as some of the contributing factors to these feelings. So please welcome our next special guests, Joe and Christy.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Christy and Joe.
Thanks for having us.
It's a great opportunity.
Would you both be able to provide a little background information about yourselves for the listeners?
You go first, Joe.
Oh, thank you. I was going to do the same for you. So my name is Joe. I use the pronouns she, her. I'm a dietitian by practice, by trade, I guess, but I have worked in eating disorders my whole career, which is about 20 years now. And so I've done the lots of different levels of care, inpatients and outpatients and day programs, but the majority of my practice has been in private practice in Melbourne and Victoria. So I have a private practice called Eat, Love, Live. We have dietitians and a physio who specializes in eating disorders. And then my other organization is with Christy, where we're co-founders of Eat, Love, Live Education, providing professional development for healthcare practitioners that is really rooted in lived experience consultation. And at this point with very much an eating disorder flavor, which is not surprising.
Definitely, you have such an array of experience. I guess on to you now, Christy.
Yeah, hi everyone. My name's Christy Bennett. Pronouns are she, her. A little bit different to Joe, I wear a couple of different hats during the week. So one of them being a clinician working with eating disorders at Eat Love Live. My other hat is I'm an academic at Monash University. So I do research into eating disorders and education and have a real passion for educating, hence our Eat, Love, Live Education, and making sure that the education that we're providing is really meeting the needs of people who we work with. So yeah.
Well, it's amazing that you're both able to work together in this space. And I guess something that we like to ask each week to our guests is about self-care. So I'm wondering, do each of you have any examples of things that you like to do to stay well?
I have a bit of a mantra or saying that I need to be around or in water to feel well. So I'm not fussy about whether it's a beach, a creek, or a bath, but as long as I can get in or around water, that's really important for my own mental health.
Oh, how wholesome. On to you, Jay. Oh,
that's a good one, Christy. That resonated with me. I think for myself, I process a lot verbally. So I'm someone who thinks aloud and processes a lot by talking it through. So being connected is really important to me. And for my self-care is often having those spaces that don't have to be formal spaces. They can just be friends. They can be anything. But to just have that opportunity to connect and download, vent, whatever it is allowed. And that's something that I've learned to value more and more. And though those spaces sometimes are more formalized, a lot of the time it's just, connecting with people over the phone, having a drink, hanging out with friends on the weekend, and just having that opportunity to, touch base.
Yeah, definitely. And that's such an invaluable skill, being able to process things while talking to people and even recognizing what you're saying as a skill of just kind of processing.
I think this is probably where Christy and I get along so well, because we're both very good at processing out loud, and we're good at brainstorming, and we're good at collaborating that way. We often end up with many more ideas than there is time.
Yes. On today, we are going to be speaking about why people may be feeling stuck with an eating disorder. So how might not seeing your relationship with food as disordered eating, how might that leave people maybe feeling stuck?
It's such a good question. And I think in the society that we live in, there's probably a lot of people that have this kind of subclinical disordered eating, just because of the way that we kind of view food and view bodies, and what is normalized. But I think the way that I would distill that kind of that question is, we need to be able to recognize, to be able to create behavior change. So if we can't actually acknowledge, articulate, and recognize that it is disordered behavior, then we're not able to change the behavior, and it will perpetuate itself.
I think that's a really beautiful reflection, Christy. And I think I just want to lean in a little bit more to that idea of what's so normalized. You know, we live in a cultural soup where, if we talk about it in terms of diet culture, that striving to always eat in the best way, in the healthiest way, in the lowest calorie, whatever it is that becomes the measure, but striving to always be seen to be doing health in a particular way has become incredibly normalized. And so it's really understandable that people don't really understand what disordered eating is, because actually disordered eating is often upheld as norm, or as normal, sorry, or as the desired, or what's being encouraged, whether that be in a medical area or whether that be in sort of more cultural expectations or what's seen to be acceptable amongst our peers. And so I think it's a really great place to start to think about, you know, we might be talking about eating disorders and disordered eating, but to also recognize that for many people, they do sit in what we would think of as a subclinical threshold, but they might not realize it because they've never been able to kind of examine the soup that they're living in, per se, and recognize the impact that the rigidity maybe around their food behaviors and thoughts and patterns is having on their life. Or they might not be in a situation where they can see that just because everyone else around them is doing the same thing, it doesn't mean it's normal.
Or okay.
Or okay. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. And I think there's a lot of people out there that struggle with their relationship with food, and they may not be aware that it is disordered. Maybe like an example of binge eating disorder, you know, eating large quantities of food and then restricting, wondering what's happening, not really understanding that it is disordered. I think a lot of people can go around experiencing these things with food without the proper kind of education to say maybe it's disordered eating, because that's not always available for people.
Absolutely.
I think an important point there is maybe that they might have an inkling that it's not quite right, but don't have the language to articulate what's happening, or the rationale to understand why it's not quite sitting well with them. To really, I think, validate that if you're feeling like you don't have that language, or you haven't seen your experience maybe represented in examples, that of course you're not going to be able to, you're not going to be able to identify this as an issue.
And I think something I've often come back to in sort of the consumer client space, but also with educated healthcare professionals, is that any distress around food and any distress around body is valid. I think that one of the barriers to, you know, feeling that, we hear a lot in the eating disorder space about not feeling sick enough. We're working against so many stereotypes and biases and poor understanding and ignorance that people often don't feel that they're sick enough to access the treatment, or they feel silly going for it. But I think we need to come back to recognizing that any level of distress around food, how someone's feeling in their body, is valid of a discussion and acknowledgement and sort of further, I guess, examination, and having that space to do that.
Yes, definitely. How might then obsessing over food and maybe weight loss then prevent someone from maybe healing their relationship with food?
That's another really great question. And I think I would go a little bit deeper into that. So why is obsessing over food or weight loss your goal at the moment? And what purpose is that serving for you? And potentially, and what Joe and I would see in clinic quite a lot, is that it's serving a role of safety, or it's serving a role of self-worth. And therefore, it's filling a space, an emotional space that needs to be filled for you to get on with your day. And I think that without acknowledging the reasons those behaviors or those cognitions exist, it can really limit your ability to move forward, because they are such core beliefs and values that need to be addressed for our own functioning, I guess, psychological functioning. So that would be my, I guess, answer to that question, is that what you're seeing there is the symptom of the cause, and it's like the tip of the iceberg. And really, we need to help you to understand that deeper understanding for you to be able to let go of some of those things. And it might not happen in the first step of treatment by any means. It might be a couple of years down the line, but in the grand scheme of things, and like zooming out and having a bit of a bird's eye view, feeling those emotional needs are going to be really important to help you move forward.
Yes, definitely. And then what about the belief that weight loss will fix your life? How might that kind of keep people feeling trapped?
I think, again, it's thinking about the cultural soup that we're living in. I think for many people, it's completely normalized that they're even talking about weight and weight loss. And for some people, that's actually being encouraged. You know, for people who might live in a higher weight body, that's actually being pushed upon them and reinforced that their body needs to be smaller to be acceptable and fit in to our culture and our society, or to feel safe in some way. And so, again, I think looking a little bit deeper is what is it about weight, the focus on weight, size, the anti-fat bias that is really driving this belief that weight loss is going to make us feel better? Because I think it really comes down to, if we dig under the surface of diet culture and things like that, it's that, I mean, you can pick the adjective, if you know, the weightism, the anti-fat bias that impacts people of all sizes. It's going to impact them in different ways, but people see the prejudice of that people in high weight bodies experience. And of course, that's going to feed into their own fear. And I think that really links into what Christy was saying around feeling safe.
No, I would build on that and just say that part of Joe and I's ethos is really to take the onus off the individual when it comes to eating disorders, disordered eating, and really that cultural safety around anti-fat bias, because what we're seeing here is a symptom of systemic oppressions and systemic or systems, I should say, inequalities, where, you know, we're seeing the patriarchy, we're seeing capitalism, we're seeing our white supremacy all playing out through the society's need to gratify weight loss. And it really is a very rational response to the society that we live in.
Absolutely.
And that sometimes we need a space to kind of unpick and unpack all of those factors that are, you know, quite philosophical really, but impact us all. And we need to keep in mind that, of course, you're going to valorize weight loss if that's what you've been programmed to do.
Yeah. I think when people, you know, really have that drive for weight loss, what I really want to share with them is that really good learners. You know, that's picking up on all of the cues around us and all of the messages around us and doing what we've been told to do. And it is very philosophical, and it is sometimes really difficult to step back and to look at all of the other influences that can drive that it is so much more than just, you know, I think that there's such an awful stereotype that it's just about appearance. So it's, I think that really invalidates people's experience, that this drive is around that safety because of all of the inequalities that people and their identities might experience.
Definitely. And it is a glamorization of weight loss. You know, it's not going to solve all of your problems. You know, it's not going to magically give you money and a partner and a great career and fulfill your friendships. Like, there's so many things that it just does not fix your life. And there are a lot of people, you know, experiencing eating disorders as a result of this kind of motivation towards and sole value of weight loss. And it's just a kind of trap in the end.
But I think just honoring the fact that that is actually the narrative that we're provided in lots of different scenarios, that, you know, if we look at social media influences or even just the media itself, there is a certain type of body that's represented often, and status comes with that. And so therefore it is a really logical response to think that if I change my body, then my status will change. So while we know that that doesn't necessarily happen, the brain connection makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so it's understandable why people do, you know, work towards that, and that is their main kind of obsession.
Exactly.
And I think we can also, I think it's quite nuanced and complicated, that for some people who might have, I use the example of someone living in a high weight body who's experiencing oppression because of that, or if we're thinking about someone who whose experience of gender doesn't fit with their sex assigned at birth, manipulating their body in some way that becomes more culturally acceptable might actually lead to them having greater status and experience. We're not by any means advocating that it's safe, that it's sustainable, that it's healthy, but I think we have to acknowledge that sometimes when people do follow through with these ideas that have been taught to them, they might actually find that they are more connected, that they do get this secondary reinforcement, and that of course can then reinforce the eating disorder behaviors and cognitions and add to the challenge of moving away from it.
It definitely does add to the fire, but then disordered eating, like we know, is not a very kind of happy place. And I guess you talked about like the impact of system oppressions. I guess could you talk about that and maybe the impact of trauma on disordered eating?
We, I guess at Eat Love Live Education, we've done some research with lived experience for people who have eating disorders. And a really big theme that came up as part of our interviews, which kind of based is the foundation of the courses in which we run, was the fact that there are systems of oppression in which we can't change that impact the development and the maintenance of eating disorder behaviors and cognitions. And Stephanie Nixon has written a great paper which has a coin analogy, and it's around people at the top of the coin often don't know that they're on the top of the coin, and they're the people with the privilege. She talks about different kind of privileges that might exist in people's lives. And really, once we peel that back, what we see is that people on the bottom part of that coin are the ones with the wisdom and the experience and the ones that we need to be listening to really fix the systems in which we exist, rather than the people on the top of the coin, which are often the academics and the policymakers, trying to fix the systems in which they don't actually experience those inequalities. And I think from our discussions with the lived experience experts that we spoke to, you know, we've spoken about this a little bit already, but sometimes those disordered eating behaviors and cognitions can really provide stability, safety. They can provide privileges that were not inherited as part of their lived experience previously. And therefore, we can kind of understand why those things have developed and why they stay there and why they're so sticky, because you know, of course you want to be in a safer space. Of course you want to be accepted by, you know, the rest of the group. We're, you know, we're members of a tribe essentially. And if we're on the outside of that tribe, our safety is compromised. So we really, you know, being in a system of oppression or not having a certain privilege within a space, and particularly in a medical setting, makes a lot of sense as to why these cognitions and behaviors develop. And I think that, and, you know, trauma comes into that, because often trauma occurs because of systems of oppression or unequal hierarchies in terms of power and balance. So I think, yeah, clinicians aren't really well taught about this either, and how to hold space for this. And that's something that Joe and I are working towards. But it's really important that we acknowledge, that we validate, and we allow space for these conversations in eating disorder spaces.
And I think building on what you were saying there, Christy, it's not often talked about the way systems of inequality, privilege, those sorts of things actually interplay in the development and maintenance of an eating disorder. If we think about a lot of all those really common things that, you know, how and why eating disorders happen, you know, genetics and biology and temperament and experiences, but these social cultural factors, these identities that people hold are so important. And the strongest message we got from the lived experience cohort we were talking to is that when they've felt stuck in seeking support, when they've felt unheard, when they've felt disempowered, when they've been seeking support, is because this part of the picture hasn't been addressed, or it's been ignored, or there's just, we can't support something we don't understand. And so the conversations really helped us to reflect and dig in a lot more. And I think, you know, reflecting on my clinical experience, this is 100% a lot of the times we know what to do with eating disorders. You know, we've got the frameworks, we've got the evidence-based treatments, but they don't work for everyone. And that's something we know. Often the reason they don't work for everyone, the stuckness that happens, and the stuckness might be on the client feeling like that they're not recovering. And I say that with inverted commas and a little fingers, which you can't see, because I think recovery in and of itself needs to be defined on an individual level. I think sometimes we set clients up to feel like they're failing just because we have expectations of what recovery should look like or what the timeline should be. And we inadvertently, as practitioners, can project that onto our clients, that they can feel like they're not getting better quick enough, or that they're stuck in a certain place. And it's trying to shine a light on some of the things that we might need to actually talk about with these clients to help share the stuckness, to help understand why they can't necessarily move past something when a system of oppression isn't in their control. One of our lived experience experts we talked about, I think the quote is, you can't CBT yourself out of oppression, which really stuck with me.
Yes. And I guess, Christy, do you have maybe any examples of where clients may be feeling kind of stuck?
The feeling of stuckness can happen at any point along the trajectory, I would say. And the first point I think that we encounter this stuckness is even reaching out for treatment. And it's what we talked about at the start, that even acknowledging that there is an issue and that you are sick enough and you're worthy of treatment can sometimes be a huge hurdle for people to actually conquer. So I think that that's probably the first point where we see this friction occur. And then, you know, even getting into the room, Joe and I talk about this all the time, validating how much energy and how much strength courage. It takes, courage, to actually step in the room with a clinician and say, hey, there's a problem here and I'm reaching out for help. And that's probably the next probably point of tension. When we're in session, there are so many points of frictional tension just because the eating disorder likes to protect itself. Like, it's a self-protective mechanism. If I just resist everything, then the eating disorder gets to stay where it is. Of course, it's going to try and protect itself to do that. But I think, you know, when we dig a little bit deeper into why are we feeling that friction, why is there some tension there, it comes down to those values that the eating disorder purports to develop with you. You know, it's saying, if you do these things, you'll be worthy in society. If you do these things, you will be considered higher status, or you will be considered a better person, and you'll be more acceptable within society. And sometimes our role as clinicians is to really challenge those thoughts. And it can take time to break that stickiness because they are such important things to our identity and to our life that we, you know, they're such fundamental concepts. So I think that, in summary to your question, I think that stickiness can happen at any point. But what we see in eating disorder work, or working with people with eating disorders, is the incredible effort and strength and courage that people come to session with. And, you know, it's such a privilege to work alongside people to undo that stickiness. And I think that as clinicians, sometimes we can overlook that. And I know that, you know, Joe shares this, our thoughts on this, but as clinicians, to have clients that are willing to keep pressing, even though it is sticky, even though people are feeling stuck, it is such a privilege to work alongside that.
I think that when we're thinking about this idea of stuckness and stickiness, and I mean, it's hard work recovering from an eating disorder. Like, eating disorders develop to help people cope, as we've talked about. You know, we've talked about it in you know, keeping us safe, in helping us to cope in some way. And the thing is, they work. They do create a sense of safety and containment, and give, you know, they have helped people to navigate all of the difficult things up to this point. There is so much wisdom in developing an eating disorder, in helping the person to navigate whatever it was that was going on for them at that point. And I think that you've really beautifully acknowledged there, Christy, the strength and bravery of coming to a space to talk about that. But I think to acknowledge that there's expectations, you know, on both the clinician, I think, and the client, of what it should look like to attend treatment, you know, how it should go. And I think that needs to be challenged for both. No two people have the same eating disorder. Of all the people I've met with an eating disorder, and I tell them all this when I first engage, is that no one develops an eating disorder for the same reason. The way they develop it, why they develop it, what it might look like, how they experience the behaviors and cognitions is going to be completely different. We have diagnostic criteria because it's really helpful, but by no means does it ever actually validate an individual experience. And so in that way, recovery and moving forward with an eating disorder is going to be incredibly individual. It's going to be so different for everybody. And I think that's where we have to be really aware as clinicians and as consumers seeking support, that there is no right way to do recovery. There is no timeline. You know, we're so lucky in Australia, we have the Medicare eating disorder care plans. You can get subsidized 20 sessions with a dietitian. It doesn't mean you're going to recover in 20 sessions. And it's awesome that we have that. And it's not a goal. So I think that that stuckness, and I guess I'm reflecting as I'm talking, as I said, I tend to do, I wonder how much the stuckness is sometimes a reflection of our expectations of what it should look like in recovery or what it should look like in treatment. And I think that comes as people being in the room, talking about their own experience, maybe understanding what disordered eating means, you know, what is normal? And again, that's, I think that's an inverted comma one there. What is disordered? What might be under the, you know, an eating disorder thought that they hadn't even picked up on before? And then developing the courage, the language to explore that. And I think that also goes along with the clinician holding space in the room that often we've done some training, we've done some reading, we've seen a few clients, and you know, we rock up with a bit of an idea of what we're going to do. And sometimes because clinicians want to help people, you know, we're ultimately there because we want to help people and we think we know what to do, and we've been taught what to do, and then we get into the room. I think both parties need permission that it's okay to just slow it down. It's okay to take the time to really explore and unpack that person's experience, because that is where, I guess that's where the good stuff is. Allowing people that space to really unpack and understand their own experience with food and body and the traumas that they've experienced in relation to food and body and the eating disorder and what might be helpful moving forward is often where we find, the bits that help us out of the stickiness. And if we overpass that and go too quickly through the assessment process or don't allow the space for someone to really dig into that and have that validated, then maybe that's where we're perhaps feeling quite stuck because what we're thinking will work isn't working.
What I would add to that as well is something that I often talk about with clients, and that is that the work doesn't happen when things are easy. The work happens when things are hard, and you actually need that stickiness, that resistance, and you know, or sometimes we call it a setback or a relapse, to actually build those skills that we need to keep you in recovery. And I guess that's validating for people. If you are feeling stuck, you know, this has a purpose, and it's not a lack of willpower. It's not an individual a lack of moral standing or whatever you might want to call it. This is part of recovery, and recovery is not a straight line. And it's actually an imperative part of recovery, because if you were to just take one step, one step, one step, one step, one step without any challenges in recovery, the next barrier you're going to face, whether it be stress, you know, change in life circumstance, trauma, those old coping strategies are going to come back, and you're not going to have the skills to actually keep yourself in recovery or whatever term you want to put there. So those, that stickiness, that resistance is actually fundamental to your journey.
Yes, definitely. And you both talked about what comes up for people individually. And I guess then what is the impact of, you know, really understanding someone's lived experience in their treatment?
It is incredibly powerful. And some of the work that I'm doing with my academic hat on is around narrative medicine. And it's a branch of medicine that we utilize people's stories to actually help them understand, you know, what's gone on. So the narrative itself, the storytelling itself, is part of the medical model that's used. And it's the story is not adjunct to the treatment. It's part of the treatment. And having that witnessed by somebody in power or within the system is the key to that being a therapeutic approach. So narrative medicine, I think, you know, we're like, oh, is this brand new thing and it's really exciting, but I think we need to acknowledge that Indigenous populations have been using this for thousands of years. And really, we're only just starting to understand the impact that that can have, which seems to be, incredibly powerful.
Yes. And it makes a lot of sense if we think about people's relationship with food and body. Where else do we have an opportunity to actually explore it? It's not something we really talk about unless we're in treatment for disordered eating or an eating disorder, where we actually have that, you know. And I'm thinking about doing assessments with clients where you ask questions about what was it like growing up in your body? When did you realize you had a body? You know, what was food like in your household? All of these sorts of discussions that we might have, that over time, I think as a clinician, I learned to spend more and more time in those discussions, because you can see people's own understanding just expanding, because we've never had the opportunity to actually explore this. And so, you know, I think it's so fantastic to, I think this is where Christy and I work well together. Christy often has the wonderful academic understanding of it. And I'm like, this thing happens in the room that I've noticed. And so we can come together and, you know, really acknowledge the important role of narrative medicine for our clients, to really uphold the importance of them as experts through experience.
Yes, it's really empowering to have people be able to reflect on their own story. And you could see in like the medical field that people are over medicalized and that they're treated kind of all the same. But this narrative medicine, it kind of sounds also like narrative therapy. Have you heard of that? Yeah. And yes. I'm wondering what the kind of differences there would be. Is it something that could be used, you know, in a hospital setting? Is it something kind of to be used under medical assessment? Is that what it kind of is?
I am by no means an expert in narrative medicine, but from my understanding, it kind of crosses between the psychological and the medical kind of expertise. So from what I understand, yes, it could be used in a clinical setting. Where we're seeing it most is really in a community setting. And I think that that is reflective of the acuity of the people that are, patients, as they're often called in hospitals, and the resourcing available. It's just not resourced to be able to spend this time to understand people's stories. Whereas in the community, we have a little bit more time and freedom to do that. So, in an ideal world, this would be part of the kind of overall treatment model. When Joe and I take over the world, we'll make sure that that is part of the treatment 100%. Model that we offer.
And you guys are doing amazing work, because you have utilized, you know, the value of lived experience in a framework that you've developed. So I guess, could you talk a little bit about radical client-centered framework?
Absolutely. The radical client-centered framework, or the RCC framework, as we tend to call it, is something that we really developed out of the lived experience consultation, qualitative-based research that we undertook with Eat, Love, Live Education. We were really passionate about wanting to provide education and training and support for health practitioners that is really rooted in and uplifting the story of lived experience, the clients that we've seen, and how that's, you know, as Christy said, I often talk about that everything I've learned has come from the clients that rock up and are willing to talk to me, and that we can learn so much about how to support others from listening to the clients we already have. And so we want to be able to capture that in some way. And so undertaking some consultation, qualitative research. Christy will talk more about the methods. Not my area. We listened, basically. We listened to what people had to say about their experience of seeking support for their disordered eating and eating disorders. We listened to what they found helpful and not helpful. We gave them the opportunity to think about what they would like to tell emerging clinicians in this space of what would be helpful and what wouldn't. And then from all of that data, a lot of reflection and analysis, we really pulled out some really interesting themes that spoke to perhaps some of the things we don't often talk about when it comes to what's leading to the development and maintenance of an eating disorder in the clinical space. I think that our clients have been telling this for a long time. So the RCC is a framework that really helps to create a little bit more of a structure of how we can think about some of the systems of oppression and things that might be influencing our clients and their relationship with food and body. Perhaps, Christy, you want to talk through the model a little bit?
Yeah, so I guess the aim of creating this framework was really to give some structure to those really difficult conversations, both for the clinician and for the client. So essentially what the RCC is, I would describe it like an onion with lots of layers, a cross-section of an onion. So right in the middle, we have the person. And that person, if we go the next layer out, is supported by their kind of social support network. So that might be friends, it might be family, it might be carers. So acknowledging the physical and social supports that are actually around that person. And that acknowledges that if those supports aren't there, that can really influence the relationship somebody has with food and their body, because that becomes a really unstable situation for them. If they've got no psychological support, if they've got no physical support, you know, I'm thinking of somebody maybe who is in a wheelchair and unable to actually go shopping or is neurodivergent, how are they actually going to access the food available? So that support network is critical to their relationship with food and body. Then if we take another step out, we have the food layer. So this talks about the intake, the behaviors, the knowledge, the practical skills, the access, the nutrient knowledge. And obviously there is overlap between the support network and the food layer, and with all the layers, I guess. But what this tries to do is really to pinpoint, okay, when it comes to food, you know, what types of things are currently here? What types of practical skills do you have? Are there barriers to access? Are there barriers to intake that we need to consider? And often in these situations, you know, we've got nutrient knowledge there, but often in these situations, it's a decentering of some of these things. So a decentering of nutrient knowledge. How important is it actually that you meet your macro goals? How important is it if you can accurately count calories or whatever it is, whatever the behavior is? And really having those conversations around why has that behavior developed and how is it serving you can really help us unpack that development of the eating disorder or the healing and what needs to take place for somebody to get to recovery, whatever that's defined for them. So then the next circle out we have is relationships and experiences with food and body. And this is where our food and body and diet related trauma really sits. So this level is to unpack kind of the programming that we've had, the experiences that we've had that have either led to developing the eating disorder or disordered eating, or that we might need to unpack for that healing to occur. And then the last circle that we have is those societal relationships. And that's coming back to those systems of oppression, the impact of cultural and societal systems on us developing these eating disorder or disordered eating behaviors. So the framework is designed to help us have those difficult conversations and maybe articulate some things that we haven't thought about as part of our development or maintenance of our eating disorder or disordered eating patterns. Yes.
I think an important one there that we haven't added, but we probably should, is actually thinking about food culture for the individual. Often as practitioners, we come into a space with our own experience of food and what's normal for us. But if we don't really truly understand what's culturally appropriate for the clients that we're seeing within their family, within, you know, their lifestyle, I think there can be some, you know, that can lead to some miscommunication and stuckness as well. And what is it that might be causing barriers?
Yes. And you've both actually kind of talked about the expectations that people can put on themselves. So it might be expectations about macros, or it might be expectations about recovery. So I guess what would you say the role is of, you know, having such high expectations for yourself on eating disorder recovery in general?
I think it's something that's so important to actually just have a conversation about. I think often that's something that I know I can reflect as a clinician, that in the spaces I hold with clients, we talk about when someone's, maybe even their perfectionism, is coming into the eating disorder space. You know, we can't recover perfectly. There is no such thing. You know, when we recover, it is, as Christy talked about, an opportunity to learn new skills by trying something different. And so recovery is going to be messy, and it's going to be grey, and it's going to be nuanced. There's no tick boxes. There's no straight line. And so I think that part of the discussion in recovery, or treatment or support or whatever you want to call it, is actually noticing when people's expectations and frustrations at themselves are coming in and actually creating some friction, and actually holding a space to help build that therapeutic relationship between the client and the clinician, to be able to have those conversations and be like, hey, you don't have to be perfect here. There's no right or wrong. You know, we're just trying something on for size. It may or may not fit. Let's just be curious about what happens next. I think the most important thing that you've really highlighted there is, Jess, is to acknowledge it and start the conversation, because that's part of the learning in that therapeutic space of noticing when our own expectations is, you know, creating a bit of a barrier or not allowing us to really appreciate the progress that's happening.
And the eating disorder is going to be perfectionistic. It loves rigidity. It loves rules. So part of our job as clinicians working with people with eating disorders is really to challenge that. But also, I see it as Joe was talking, I'm thinking, like, my visual is that the person we're working with has kind of got this blurred vision of what's happening around them. And our role as eating disorder clinicians is really to hold their hand, walk beside them, and allow them to be able to see the next step. As clinicians, hopefully we've got a bit of an idea of what that looks like for that person, a kind of a bird's eye view, but it might feel really scary for that person who can't see what's coming up next. And that's the trust and the privilege that we have as clinicians working in this space, is that we get to actually stand beside you and we get to, you know, navigate the process with you. And hopefully it feels like the person that you're working with, whether it be a dietitian, psychologist, psychiatrist, whoever that is, you've got trust in that relationship, and it feels like you've kind of got a captain of the ship. And this person is kind of working with you to find that destination that you need to go.
Yes, definitely. So do you guys have any advice for someone who is feeling stuck with an eating disorder and is unsure how to bring about any change?
I think the most important thing is to acknowledge that we see you, we get it, that being stuck and feeling stuck is really a reflection that you're trying really hard to work against and push back against the eating disorder, and that it's not a reflection of not doing it right or not trying hard enough or not being engaged enough. It's actually just a reflection that the eating disorders per se are awful, and they're dangerous, and they're powerful, and they're sticky. And so feeling stuck is a really normal part of the process, and it's not something to be afraid of. Feeling stuck is an invitation to dig in and get curious. Sometimes it's about finding the right questions, conversation topics to be able to dig in and understand a little bit further. And I guess that's, you know, the framework we've talked about is a visual cue that we hope can prompt some of those discussions, whether it be in a session for a client and their clinician, whether it be for a client separately or a clinician separately, to just reflect on all of the different things that could possibly be influencing how they're feeling right now, where they might be struggling with their eating disorder to move forward. But to know, I guess, the biggest message that I want to come back is to know that being stuck doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It actually means you're doing it right.
I would just add to that. So absolutely, the biggest message is we see you, and that this is actually an expected part of the process. As frustrating as that can be to hear, reaching out for help from professionals can be a really great way of helping you become unstuck and just pulling out to have a bigger, broader view of the progress that you've actually made is sometimes helpful for somebody else to reflect that back to you. The other things that I'd probably recommend or encourage is that we try and connect with people around you, with community, with an identity outside of the eating disorder. And, you know, that might be, you know, I have clients where Dungeons and Dragons groups are really great for them to kind of get out of the eating disorder kind of cognition headspace. Or it might be, you know, swimming laps in a pool if that's safe for you. Or it might be connecting with friends over some other, you know, hobby. But really try and find an identity outside of the eating disorder. And remember that we all have internalized biases and the cognitions and behaviors that come along with that. And that's going to influence the way that we view recovery, but also that recovery is not that straight line. And I'd come back to that the resistance, the stickiness is where the work happens, and it's actually a critical part of the process.
Yes, and the feeling stuckness also indicates, like you were both saying, that there is some motivation and some inner knowing that you don't want the eating disorder and that there is a step forward. It's just about which step that is.
It's the healthy self coming through, right? If we think about it in terms of, you know, therapy speak. But it's that healthy voice saying something's not right here. I'm feeling like we're not progressing. Why is that? And feeling uncomfortable with that is actually a really healthy response.
Yes. And I really loved your reflection there, Christy, of sometimes it's really helpful to have someone on the outside reflecting movement progress back to us, because I think we need to be aware that the steps forward aren't always consistent in size. Sometimes they're very small and they still count. And sometimes they're big leaps. And so it's sometimes really helpful to just have that space where you can discuss it and have reflected back to you. We have to take, we have to take those little steps to really move forward, I guess.
Yes. And I like that you both said that having the healthy self for yourself, or having a clinician or people around you who have their healthy self coming to the forefront, can be really powerful with helping to feel unstuck. So I guess I wanted to say thank you so much for this episode, both of you. It has been sensational.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It's been lovely.
Well, that's the end of today's episode. Please subscribe, leave us a comment or a review. If you would also like to learn more about Body Matters services, you can check out our website at bodymatters.com.au. Thanks for listening.